Wednesday, November 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Election Day in the United States with record voter turnout as Americans explain why they showed up.
I didn't want to rely on mail. I wanted to be sure physically that I touched it.
Regardless of who wins, national security experts say the divisiveness in the U.S. is a gift to foreign adversaries. Also ahead, we'll explain just how the U.S. votes are actually counted. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, as you heard at the top of the hour, Americans have gone to the polls. It is still Tuesday, Election Day, and some places are still open for voting, with the ballot counting likely to continue throughout the night. Joining us for an update on where President Trump and his Democratic rival Joe Biden spent Election Day and what the plans are for later in the evening, VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, what can you tell us?
The president midday left the White House. Took the motorcade to Arlington, Virginia, to essentially the nerve center for the campaign to rally the troops there. He did speak to reporters, expressed an upbeat mood. He was asked a couple of questions by reporters and said he hadn't really prepared an acceptance or a concession speech. He said winning is easy and losing is a lot harder, but he was acknowledging the possibility that there might have to be a concession speech. Joe Biden went into Scranton, Pennsylvania, his native state, did a sort of nostalgia tour, visiting the home he grew up in and dropping into a couple of businesses. Very casual comments from the former vice president there. He returned to Wilmington, Delaware after that, and there have been indications from his campaign that he is prepared to address the nation this evening. But we're also hearing from his campaign that if there's really nothing significant to say tonight, then he won't be making that appearance, and will save his remarks for tomorrow.
Joe Biden will be in his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware, waiting to see what happens and may or may not speak. And what's President Trump planning on doing? Where is he planning on watching the results come in, and does he have anything planned?
Yes, he is staying in the White House. There had been attempts to organize a party at his hotel down the street from the White House, but the local officials in Washington, D.C., said any big gathering would be a violation of the coronavirus pandemic social distancing protocols. He's invited perhaps 200 people over to the East Room of the White House, and I am certain that we will be hearing from the president repeatedly on Twitter and perhaps speaking to reporters, or possibly if he feels that there is this predicted great red wave he has spoken about, that he would ask to speak to the nation and declare victory. But we have been cautioned for days and weeks not to really expect a definitive outcome, basically because we have to find out what happens in Pennsylvania. And that is a state where there was heavy advance voting by mail-in ballots and such. And it's going to take a long time, days, to count those ballots, according to officials in that state. But if there is a big trend one way or the other, we could be hearing from either or both of the candidates.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, thanks so much. Well, VOA has been speaking to voters in the Washington, D.C. area about what has been driving them to vote. Here's a sampling of what we're hearing.
You know the vote is important by all of the measures that they are taking to suppress the vote.
I'm here because everyone should vote. We don't tell them how to vote, but they need to vote. This president is not dealing with what we call the Bill of Rights. But the most important thing here is to recognize it's climate change, global warming, and do no harm.
You know, it's just a civic duty. The country is founded on, founded for us, and voting is how you kind of reaffirm that. I consider it a patriotic duty to wear a mask as well as to vote, and so I came.
Well, it's a real consequential election that we have every 4 years, and it never has felt more important than quite now, so I thought I'd get out and get my voice heard. It can be very dangerous if you don't mind your democracy and turn out to vote as people didn't really turn out to vote as much in 2016. After 4 years of turmoil, looks like we're very much back in the business of getting our voices heard.
It's our civic duty. It's everybody should vote no matter what. I mean, we're lucky we have that. A lot of countries don't.
This time, the voting is very important, and this is my right also.
I'm happy to be able to vote. I know there's a lot that are not able to for one reason or another, and whether I agree with what you agree with, I'm happy everybody gets an opportunity to express their opinions.
Crowds of people have been gathering throughout the evening near the White House. VOA Africa 24's Ayen Dangbior was on scene and filed this report.
It's election night 2020, and we're here near Black Lives Matter Plaza by the White House. It's a lovely evening. It's not too cold, and the atmosphere is actually quite festive right this moment. There are people dancing to music provided by a go-go band, and you can probably hear it right now. There's poster art. There was even a dance group that performed not too long ago. Some parts of Black Lives Matter Plaza tonight feel a lot like a party, and the organizers and activists behind tonight's event say that is exactly the theme they were going for. They wanted to throw an election watch party, and in fact, there are two projector screens that I've seen that are showing news stations report as the polls close. But despite all of this, there is still tension in the air. There is chanting closer to Lafayette Square, similar to what we heard months ago during the racial justice protest. People are calling for reforms and an end to police brutality. There's also people here carrying anti-Trump signs, and I saw one person who wrote, "I love Trump" on his poster, even as votes are still being counted across the country tonight, creating an air of uncertainty. And you can see that uncertainty when you see shops and businesses with windows boarded up, and there are members of the press here wearing protective jackets and helmets. And of course, there are numerous police here as well. But for now, it's too early to tell if this mood will hold up for the rest of the night or if things will change. This is Ayen Dangbior for VOA News, Washington.
Well, in past years, when Election Day arrived in the United States, once the polls closed, election watchers gathered exit polls and watched the vote counts come in across the country. But this year is different, not only because of the pandemic, but because many Americans have voted early, often by mail-in ballots. To explain how VOA will be monitoring the election and calling states for each candidate, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to VOA senior executive producer Steve Reddish via Microsoft Teams.
The biggest reason we may not know a winner tonight is because of the massive amount of mail-in voting that happened over the last 6 weeks. It started in the middle of September when the first states were able to send in mail-in ballots. So the early voting is now about 70% of what it was in 2016. And much of that is mail-in votes to states that haven't had the experience in dealing with such massive amounts of counting absentee ballots. The states that do have the best track record and have been doing it the most are actually two battleground states, North Carolina and Florida. They count their absentee ballots on the day, on Election Day. They've started already counting the ballots. And by the time the polls close in each of those states, they'll be sending out word about not just today's vote, the people who walk up and vote today, but all of those people who have voted in the past. There are a few states that just don't deal with this very well. And actually three of them, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, are all key states for both President Trump and Joe Biden to win. So those three states may not have a final count for about maybe a day, maybe 2 days. So they'll be slow in counting. That said, there may be a winner declared tonight, depending on how other states count their absentee ballots.
Now, speaking of that, people who have watched previous U.S. elections may be familiar with TV broadcasts with big U.S. electorate maps on the screen and broadcast journalists calling elections for certain states for certain candidates. What's the process going to be for this election?
VOA does not have the capability of going into various different states and doing the kind of data crunching that is necessary to come up with those projections. So we're relying on the Associated Press and Reuters, both of whom are doing it differently. The Associated Press is crunching their own numbers and getting information in from from all of the states as far as their vote count. And they have done some exit polling. They have gone out and polled some people both today and in the weeks prior for people who have sent in absentee ballots and voted early. Reuters is subscribing to another service that does pretty much the same thing. They get the raw vote in. They have done exit polling with a percentage of voters in key places in each state to be able to try and get a better idea of the picture of today's voting. All of that said, all of the organizations are going to be very conservative, and they're going to be waiting until they actually get raw vote in before making many of the calls, specifically the calls in the states that are key, like Florida, like North Carolina, like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and Arizona. Those states will be methodically counting, and the networks will be waiting until they get a lot of raw vote in before making a decision that one candidate just can't get enough votes to beat the other candidate.
VOA senior executive producer Steve Reddish speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Record numbers of young American adults known as millennials are running for state and local offices this year. VOA's Esha Sarai speaks with a few of them about their motivations and their chances.
The roughly 80 million Americans called millennials comprise a large, diverse, and important part of the U.S. electorate this year. But they also make up an increasing share of the candidates for local and state elections. Layla Zaidan, executive director of the Millennial Action Project, says record numbers of people under 45 are running for office this year.
It blew us away because from 2018 to 2020, we've tracked a 266% increase. The number of people who threw their hat in the ring on election day on the ballot, we'll have 259 total millennials just running for congressional seats.
Campaigning on issues like climate change and wage stagnation, millennial candidates say they want a hand in shaping policy that will affect their future, says David Kim, a Democratic candidate for the House of Representatives in California's 34th district.
But the reality is that the consequences and ramifications of the decisions that are being made will be felt by us. So wouldn't it make sense for us to legislate for our future?
The increase in millennials running for office spans almost equally across both parties. According to the Millennial Action Project, 40% of candidates under 45 running for the House of Representatives are Republicans. But this generation is more likely than any other to identify as independent, or at least not fit neatly into the ideological box of either party. Luke Negrin, a Republican candidate for the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania's 18th district, says he's running as a Republican out of necessity.
I'm not a huge fan of the two-party system, but my opponent's a Democrat. I have to run as a Republican for a viable campaign. That doesn't mean that I think that all Republicans are good guys, and it certainly doesn't mean that I think that the only elitist sellouts are Democrats.
Zaidan says there are many policy issues, including the urgency of the COVID-19 pandemic, which have contributed to a growing number of younger candidates running for office. But the pandemic in particular has provided a unique opportunity for young candidates. In a time where large gatherings are banned for safety and people are confined to their homes, young candidates generally possess the unique advantage of knowing how to campaign online, specifically through social media.
We have started to understand how our actions can now lead to change and how we can leverage technology and leverage the power of social media to do that. And of course, in a COVID era where young people are running for office, that gives them a massive edge.
Kim, who has picked up high-profile endorsements from American politicians since he first started running last year with a staff of two people, said his volunteer base now includes over 200 volunteers, making phone calls and sending texts. All of that work now comes down to Tuesday, as Kim joins other political hopefuls in trying to win a seat in the House of Representatives. Esha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
This has been a very challenging time for the U.S. with the election, worsening pandemic, and a deeply divided nation over a host of issues. Adding to this, the age of disinformation coming from domestic and foreign actors at a time when people are hungry for information. Joining us now is Jamil Jaffer, founder and executive director of the National Security Institute, and he's also the director of the National Security Law and Policy Program at George Mason University. Thanks so much. So you've been writing about the dangers of disinformation and our own divisions, bitterness, conspiracy theories. Just how detrimental do you believe all of this is to our national security and actually the core of democracy itself?
Laura, you know, we are facing significant challenges as a country today. We are divided over a lot of big issues, as you say, whether it's racial justice or economic situations in the current COVID scenario or politics. And today's election, obviously, is dividing the country. At the same time, you know, Americans have always gotten through times like this by coming together and really have succeeded by being innovative, able to change rapidly, able to pivot on a dime. And I hope and anticipate that in the aftermath of this election, which will be intensely fought over the next at least 12 hours, if not the next 24, 48, 72 hours, as we see the results come in and there are inevitable challenges to those results, I think we'll see how this plays out. But I think that what it really takes for America to come together will be leadership. We need our leaders to step up and say, now's the time to unite the country, right? And whether that's Donald Trump in a re-election scenario or Joe Biden in a victory scenario, whoever leads this nation going forward needs to bring the country together. And it's not just elected leaders, Lori. It's also the responsibility of some of our public institutions like the media, right? Or private institutions, but play a public role. And, you know, what we've seen in the media of late, and frankly, it's been years now, and maybe even past this presidency going back, you know, you can always expect there's one or two channels that are on one side or the other, right? But what we've seen in the media writ large is sort of more op-ed and less news. And what we really need is we need news. We need facts, hard facts. And so what I think the media can do to help is, I don't have a problem with the media talking about and providing their opinions, but like, let's label it. Let's call when a news broadcaster is on TV saying, hey, here's a point of view, right? Tell us what the facts are and tell us what your view of it is and differentiate between the two so we know. So it's not all being conflated, right? And then we talk about the internet scenario and sort of all the information we get from social media and the like. A lot of people are talking about suppressing information or properly preventing foreign disinformation by shutting down speech. I actually think the best answer to speech you don't like and bad speech is more speech of the right kind, of the facts, of the truth. And so what I'd like to see platforms do is tell us who's doing the speaking, right? Give us more information on who's doing the speaking and point us in the direction of other information, right? Don't cut off people's ability to speak, particularly I'm talking about Americans here specifically, particularly not on political issues. Instead, let's have more information out there. And I think that these are a few ways that our social media platforms, our media, and our elected leaders can help us move the ball forward. And I was proud to write this op-ed with General Keith Alexander, Army four-star retired general who served his country for 3 decades.
How detrimental could all of the divisiveness and disinformation be to our national security, given that we've already been hearing about, you know, concerns about cyber attacks? We've actually heard of recent cyber attacks in hospitals. How much is the division, the divisive language, and the misinformation, disinformation detrimental to national security?
The threat that foreign disinformation and our own divisiveness and our own discord in America plays in national security is that it makes us weaker to the rest of the world. As we focus on ourselves and focus on our own disagreements, we're less able to defend our allies, protect our interests around the globe. And our enemies see that, and they are able to take steps to enhance their own interests, right? And so you look around the globe today, and we have had two presidents in a row now that have preferred that we step back from the world. Again, in very different ways, right? President Obama and President Trump are very different presidents, but they had a very similar view when it came to our role abroad. They both thought we should bring our troops home, we should focus here in the United States. And again, whether we agree with that or not is less of the point, and more of the point is our allies have seen that, and they've seen a step back from leadership in the world for now going on 12 years, and they recognize that, and they see a vacuum. And so it's not a surprise that you see China building islands in the South China Sea, Russia invading Crimea and being more aggressive around the globe, including in the Syrian conflict, right? Iran expanding its efforts in Yemen and around the region and trying to destabilize places, right? North Korea not just building nuclear weapons, but testing missiles. So we've seen an increasing pace of our adversaries being able to do things in the world at times because the U.S. has stepped back from leadership. And so, you know, until the U.S. is prepared to step forward and lead, right, it's going to be a challenge. And it's hard to do that when you're divided at home and when it's not only just internal disagreement, but that internal disagreement is being magnified by foreign adversaries who are pouring gas on existing flames. Again, it's not that we don't have disagreements in this country. We do, and we should. There are things that are problems in this country, whether it's about racial justice or about the economic situation or about tax reform or the like. But what we shouldn't let happen is foreign actors pour gasoline on that fire and allow ourselves to be lit up as a result of that. It's finally have our own Discord. It's a problem when we allow foreign actors to enhance that.
Jamil Jaffer, founder and executive director of the National Security Institute and director National Security Law and Policy Program at George Mason University, thanks so much. Social media companies have been making a lot of changes ahead of the U.S. election to stop the spread of misinformation. But will it be enough? We hear more from VOA's Michelle Quinn.
As Americans await the outcome of Tuesday's national elections, Twitter, Facebook, Google, and other internet firms will be busy doing something else, monitoring their sites and deciding which posts to allow and when to stop the spread of misinformation. It's important for the companies to do something, since most of Americans get their news from internet sites, says Hani Farid, a professor at UC Berkeley.
We've clearly entered an age where you can't believe what you read, see, or hear online. The online information ecosystem is a dumpster fire, let's be honest with each other.
At issue, will internet sites be conduits of misinformation about voting, election results, and post-election turmoil? And what actions might malicious content spark? Said Shannon McGregor, an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
That's the real fear, is that there'll be some sort of misinformation, cobbled together with calls for some type of action. Or that people may take that as a call to action, whether or not it even includes an explicit one. And I think that's the real fear right now, is that there'll be some sort of civic unrest.
Twitter has started labeling some factually questionable tweets about election issues and pointed users to credible information. The company says it will flag tweets if candidates prematurely claim victory. Facebook said it could turn to so-called break glass options. That could mean taking steps the firm reportedly has used in other parts of the world, like Sri Lanka and Myanmar. Deactivating hashtags related to false information about election results. Suppressing viral posts that spread messages of violence or fake news. The problem with online misinformation is that it can spread widely before internet sites, which are also sensitive to claims they are suppressing certain viewpoints, decide to act, said Shannon McGregor.
I worry if they'll break the glass as quick as it might need to be done, depending on sort of what is happening in our post-election period.
While U.S. voters chart the future course of the nation, election 2020 is another test case of whether social media helps or hurts the democratic process. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Yeah. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndumbulo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. As the African diaspora heads to the polls, a report by Pew Research Center shows a growing voting bloc as Black voters in the U.S. of all backgrounds are among the most motivated in the 2020 election, and their motivations vary. VOA's Solomon Solomon has the story.
For most African immigrants in the U.S., the right to vote is precious. And Ivo Tesong, a Cameroonian-American who immigrated to the U.S. in 1986, said voting is something he would never take for granted.
Being fortunate to migrate and come and live in the United States, that civic duty cannot be taken for granted because we know what our families are going through back home. We have a war right now that we've lost many family members, friends, and the government's response has not been adequate to call for a peaceful settlement to the crisis. So here, if we are also complacent, then it's a lose-lose situation.
Tesong is one of an estimated 2.4 million foreign-born African immigrants in the country, most of whom are eligible to vote, according to the U.S. Census figures. He owns a technology business in Silver Spring, Maryland, and is the chairperson of the U.S. Cameroon Democracy Network. And although he is supporting Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, he has helped register people of all political beliefs.
What we're trying to do is let each and every community member understand that we cannot stay in the fringes and not get involved, because those issues that are important to the mainstream Americans are also very important to us. As a community, go and vote early. If it rains, please take an umbrella, sit in, stick it out.
A new report by the Pew Research Center found that Black voters of all backgrounds are among the most motivated in the 2020 election.
Of those who were coming from among Black immigrants in the United States, we did see a fivefold increase of the total population coming from who are Black and immigrants. So this is really high in terms of, this makes up about 10% of the Black American population are immigrants.
That was Neil Ruiz, an associate director of Global Migration Demography Research at the Pew Research Center. The center found that voters with African heritage are poised to continue playing a large role since they are younger than the electorate at large.
4 in 10 Black eligible voters are millennials or Gen Zers, so they're younger. So in all 9 battleground states, for instance, millennials, those who are currently ages 24 to 39 in 2020, make up a slight plurality of all Black eligible voters.
And although polls have found that majority of Black voters back Biden in the presidential election, the African diaspora is not a monolithic voting group. There are no definitive surveys as to its political leanings. And the Somali American community in Minneapolis, some say they are voting Republican. Sophia Yassin Farah said she has grown disillusioned after years of voting for Democrats.
When I saw the kids, they don't have programs. They don't have any community, you know, centers that can help the kids. We have a lot of problems with kids with drugs. We have a lot of kids with, you know, who went to prison. They were born during that 20 years that I lived here. And I, when I look at the policies, Democrats, it's just going to stay the same.
Others in the African diaspora stress the need to think local first, regardless of party lines. Olanike Adebayo lives in Miami and has roots in Nigeria through her father. A lawyer, she ran for circuit court judge and lost both times. Adebayo says a host of offices matter besides the national posts.
November is very important for all of us, but I'm always stressing that local elections matter. They affect your everyday life, your local officials. We have constitutional issues and county referendums, and all those are important. But the people who do your everyday life, your councilwomen, your men, your school boards, your judges, those are your primaries, and that's when it's really important to vote.
Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Stay with VOA throughout the day and the coming days to find more as results come in on the U.S. election. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.